Good evening. It is good to be with you in this lectureship. What a blessing it has been for me, and I look forward to hearing more wonderful speakers as we have heard this afternoon. And I just came in this afternoon, and my cup is already running over. And I'm thankful to be here with you this evening to study God's Word together. If you would, go ahead and be opening to Psalms 127. Psalms 127. In just a minute, we'll look at our text for this evening from that particular passage. Slaying giants. If we're going to talk about homes that are able to face infidelity, homes that are faithful, homes that are being what God designed homes to be, we're definitely talking about a giant of a challenge. When we read through the book of Genesis, it's hard for us to find a functional family. We see that from the very beginning, it has been difficult for us as husbands and wives, mothers and fathers, sons and daughters, to be what God designed for us to be. A little bit on the lighter side, I think about the story that reveals the challenge of it. A lot of these stories start out, the guy's on a beach, he sees a bottle, he unlocks it, and a genie pops out. And he says, hey, I'll give you one wish. And he, without even having to think about it, says, I know what I want. I've always wanted to see Hawaii, but the problem is I'm afraid to fly and I get motion sickness on a boat. So what I would like is a bridge that would go from the west to Hawaii so I could drive there. Oh, and the genie is just so mad, and he's flushed and his nostrils are flaring. He says, listen here, buddy. Do you realize the architectural wonder that would be? Do you realize how much concrete that would take? Do you realize how deep the pillars would have to be to go to the bottom of the Pacific Ocean? Here, I'm going to give you another chance, and you come up with something that's reasonable. He thinks for a minute. He says, you know, I've always wanted to understand my wife. And he said, you know, like when she says, fine, that means that she's excited about what I'm doing? Or when she says, thanks a lot, is that like gratitude with an emphasis on it? Or why is it that a woman has to have a pair of shoes that's a different pair of shoes for every outfit? Or why is it that she can be biting her bottom lip and staring out the passenger window of the car? What are you thinking about? She says nothing. Is she really thinking about nothing? Why is it that she cries at nothing? Why is it that she laughs sometimes when I don't understand at all what she's laughing at? Why is it that she expects me to be able to read her mind? He says, you get the idea. I just like to understand my wife. Oh, the genie is about to lose it this time. He is so mad he's shaking and says, listen here, buddy, do you want that bridge 2-lane or 4-lane? Now, if you've been married more than 6 weeks, 6 days, you know there's a lot of truth to the fact that marriages can be challenging. Obviously, marriages can be very rewarding. God did not plague us with something when He gave us marriage. God gave us a very beautiful gift, and with that gift comes heavy responsibility. But yet when we look today in America, we see that there are half as many divorces each year as there are marriages recorded. And then when we think of those that do survive, one statistic said when they ask, are you happily married, only 60% of the survivors said they were happily married. That means there's 40% of the 50% that did make it that says, we're married, but we're not happy. Listen, did God design marriage just for us to survive? Well, we must be doing really a great job. We're faithful Christians. We haven't gotten a divorce yet. Or did God design marriage for us to thrive? Spiritually thrive. What is it that our lives says about God? What is it that our marriages says about God? What is it that because of the things that we avoid speaks volumes for God? Tonight I'd like for you to see a very short verse that we could literally study this verse for weeks. The psalmist says it in Psalms 127 and verse 1 in a very straightforward, easy to understand, practical way. He says, unless the Lord builds the house, they labor in vain who build it. Unless the Lord guards the city, the watchman stays awake in vain. When we think of giant slayers, there is none more famous that has ever lived than that of David. Isn't it interesting to think that Goliath was around 9 foot tall, and if he was a muscular, fit individual, he probably weighed around 400 to 450 pounds? And isn't it amazing that David was able, by faith with God and the partnership with God, he was able to bring that giant down? But yet at another time that he could have slain another giant in his life, he wasn't able to take his eyes away from the infidelity. Instead, he stared at Bathsheba, and then he inquired, even finding out that she was the wife of one of his mighty men, Uriah. He still calls her into him, and he commits adultery with her. Now, isn't it interesting, sad interest, that here a man who physically can slay giants, but yet it is the temptation that he brought into his life, looking at a woman, that causes Nathan to come and say to him, "You are the man." In other words, we could say it applying to this lesson tonight, you're the man that has been slain by a giant. And there's going to be penalties for that. The sword is not going to leave your family. And for the rest of David's life, he carried the burden of that coming true. You see, his son Solomon would write not about the particular woman, but in Proverbs the 7th chapter, he would write about this particular giant. In Proverbs 7, he would say in 26, "For she has cast down many wounded," talking about infidelity, personified fornication or adultery. He says, "She has cast down many wounded, and all who were slain by her were strong men." Listen, there's not a man nor a woman that can say, "That will never be a temptation to me." And when we say, who falls at this temptation, God makes it very clear. It's some of the strongest men that fall at this temptation. In other words, the lesson seems to be very clear from the Scriptures that you and I will not win this battle alone. David didn't defeat Goliath alone. David did walk into adultery by leaving God behind, and he was slain. And tonight, we think about the words of the psalmist in Psalms 127 and 1, "Unless the Lord builds the house, they labor, they work hard." Here's this good couple that they're going to build a strong marriage, but they're not building it with God. They labor, but they labor in vain. It's a little rat on the rat wheel. They're running hard. They're wanting to build something grand, but why doesn't it work? Why doesn't it stick? Why doesn't it pay off? Because they're laboring in vain. What do we have to do for it to count? What do we have to do for it to be productive, fulfilling, satisfying, eternally rewarding? I'd like for you to imagine two vacant lots. And as you pass over the days, you see that there's construction taking place on both vacant lots. When houses are done, there's one lot that the curb appeal is absolutely amazing to that house. The architecture is splendid. The roof line is lovely. The windows are beautiful. And you walk into the house and it almost takes your breath. You see the beautiful trim work and you realize that there were very skilled craftsmen that worked on this house. And as you walk across the floor, everything feels so solid. And you look at the detail in the cabinetry and you see everything is absolutely perfect. And without any shadow of a doubt, there is a master builder who has built this house. And next door, that other vacant lot, that couple decided to build it on their own. No, they've never built a house before, but they went down to the local building supply store. And they just began walking around picking out things. They didn't really even know how to build a foundation. They didn't know how to frame a house. They didn't know how to dry it in. They didn't know how to finish it. But they said, "We're going to work hard." Labor in vain. "They're going to work hard." And so they began working hard. And when they finished, it looked a lot like 10, 11-year-old boys had built a clubhouse out back. You wouldn't dream of staying in it during a storm because you know it's not going to stand long term. And you step back and you view both of those houses. houses, and you say there's just hardly any comparison between those two houses. Why? Because one couple said, we can't build houses on our own. But we know a master builder that we can join with. And we can allow him to build our marriage. We can allow him to build our home. And then over here to the side is a couple that says, oh, we've got the greatest intentions in the world. Well, our grandparents were married for 60 years. We know how to do this. We're going to make it work. Tonight, I'd like for you and I at this point to admit to ourselves that if you're married, you can't make it on your own. You don't just know how to build a strong marriage. You just don't know how on your own to guard that marriage and protect it from the temptation that Satan will bring into it. If all of us would humbly admit that even though we might have a lot of zeal and we might be willing to work hard, we're going to be laboring in vain unless we say, Lord, Thy will be done in everything dealing with my marriage. But where does it begin? Well, let's go back to the beginning. Look back, if you will, to Genesis, the first chapter. We're still thinking about building this home and allowing God to build the home. But there's really two aspects, if you will, under this one point that I'd like for us to notice about the Lord building the home. First thing we have to have to build a home is we have to have a husband and a wife. We have to have the people. And so let's think about them individually for just a moment before we think about them together in marriage. And so we think about who's going to come into this marriage. Two halves don't make a whole when it comes to marriage. It's two whole people that spiritually they're whole and they're well in their relationship with God that come together to make a strong marriage. It is a dangerous thing to coast off that philosophy that says, oh, I'm a half and I just lean on them and I would never make it through this world if it weren't for them. They're my other half and I just wouldn't. Listen, are they your God? Are they your spouse? Until you can say, my God is the one I lean upon. My God is the one that created me and sustains me day in and day out. And I love my spouse and I'm thankful for my spouse, but it is God that I lean upon. When two whole people come into a relationship, they can have one strong, healthy marriage if they continue to allow God to build that marriage. How does the Bible begin? Someone says, well, Genesis 1 is a story of creation. It is, but isn't it a lot more than that? You see, the reality is it's not just a story of creation told in chronological order. When we look at the first 34 verses of the Bible, it is a story of creation, but the emphasis is not on creation. The emphasis is upon the Creator. God is mentioned specifically by the name God 35 times in 34 verses. It's the way the Bible begins. It's the way the Gospel of John begins. When Paul stood in Athens talking to people who did not know God and said, let me tell you about the unknown God. Where did it begin? All of those beginning points are at the same place. Where is it? It's saying, let me tell you who the Creator is. Until I understand who has created me individually, I cannot understand what I am supposed to be in marriage. And so when we see this story of creation about God being the Creator, He reveals to us just a little bit in the first chapter of how He made man. Drop back and look at verse 27 of Genesis 1 where He says, so God created man in His own image. Key in on that word image there. God created man in His own image. In the image of God, He created him. Male and female, He created them. When we drop down to the second chapter, verse 7, we see that He breathed into man in his nostrils the breath of life. And so now man has a soul. That's different from the elephants and from the bears and the dogs and the cats and the eagles and the hawks. There's something different. What? They're made. Man is made after the image. What does that word mean? The image of God. The word image means representative of. Does that sink in? What are we supposed to be? Not the couple, the individual, the husband, the wife. What are we individually supposed to be in marriage? A representative of God. Friends, if we're ever going to slay the giants in our life, it's not going to be because we're focusing on the giants. It's going to be because we're focusing on God. In Colossians, the third chapter, I'd like to show you this word in the New Testament. In Colossians, the third chapter, let's look at image. And you preachers will know what I'm talking about. We need to just stop right here and have a whole sermon on the third chapter, verses 1 through 12. We can't do that right now on this. But when you drop down to verse 10, you notice we're in the middle of a sentence here in verse 10. And notice that word image again. And he says, and now, this is Colossians 3 and 10, and have put on the new man. There's something new here. We put on the new man who is renewed in knowledge according to the image of him who created him. In the Greek, the word image is icon. Isn't that interesting? When you want to open a particular application, you look for the icon to click on, because that icon takes you to what? It takes you to the application. In other words, the icon is a type of representative, if you will, to say, if you'll follow me, click on me, I will take you to this application. And so what are we individually? God made us to be what? He didn't make the bear. He didn't make the elephant to say, if you follow the bear, he'll take you to God. But he did make man with a soul. And then he made man a second time. An example of that is in Romans, the first chapter, and Ephesians, the second chapter, and verse 10. The English word in Ephesians 2 and 10 is workmanship, or the workmanship of Christ, created for good works in Christ Jesus. That workmanship there, it's the only two times that it's used in the Bible. Romans 1, he's talking about being the workmanship physically. God made us physically. Ephesians 2 and 10 is about God made us spiritually, if we choose to be made again, after the image of Jesus Christ. To do what? Our purpose. Our purpose is for good works. And so what is our life about? Our life is to be a reflection of Jesus Christ. If individuals move closer to you, they should be moving closer to God. They should be knowing more about God. You should be getting them closer to God by the way you talk, by the way you act, by the way you react, by the things you don't do, the things you do. That's Genesis 1. That is the master. Remember Psalms 127:1, lest the Lord build the house, they labor in vain who build it. The Lord first builds the people before he builds the marriage by his plan. Who are you individually? You know, it's so easy for us to want to change our spouses. Listen, we don't change each other. We don't live each other's lives. But what we can change is we can make sure that we individually are a reflection of God in everything. But then we go back to Genesis, the second chapter. And when we go back, we see the second chapter is a story of creation. And the emphasis in the second chapter is upon mankind. This is where we see man's home, the garden that was built for him. This is where we see God showing us. This time, by the way, Genesis 2 is not in chronological order. And so we get to kind of go back in time, if you will, and we get to see the creation of Eve. And, you know, it's an interesting story where for the first time, God said it wasn't good. At the end of each day, he'd been saying it is good, it is good, it is good. But then when we come to the second chapter, verse 18, it's the first time that he said it is not good that man should be alone, and I'll make him a helper comparable. But before he made that helper comparable, he allowed Adam to realize that he would want a helper comparable. And so he had him to name all of the animals. And can you imagine how that is? I only have three children, but I got to tell you, we started running out of names until we got a third child. I mean, if it had just been first names, we'd have been all right. But first and second, you know, I tell you what my theory is. Hey, kids, this isn't in the Bible. But this is my theory. This is my theory about how he named the animals. It probably went something like this with the sheep coming up at the very end. It probably went something like, okay, I'll call you chickens. You can be a rooster and you can be a hen. Okay, I'll call you cattle. You can be a bull and you can be a cow. Okay, I'll call you goats and you can be a billy and you can be a nanny and horses. You know, it just went on and on and on and on and on. And finally, the last stragglers to come up to be named, they were the sheep. And the sheep come up, running out of names. Says, I'll call you a ram and I'll call you... All right, probably it didn't go that way. But at the end of the day, or at least the end of naming all the animals, he recognized what God obviously already knew. All of them had companions, and he didn't. We had the first surgery. God puts him to sleep, removes his rib. He creates woman. Now, notice this, because I know you've heard it many times, but I want us in just a moment to flip over to another section of the Bible. And I wouldn't say this is a huge deal, except God says this is a huge deal. And so notice how when Eve is created, let's begin reading now at 23. Adam said, you know, he's been naming all day long, so now he's going to name her. And Adam said, "This is now bone of my bones and flesh of my flesh. She shall be called woman because she was taken out of man." See the source there? She's from me, so this is why I'm going to give her this name. I'm going to give her the name woman because she is from man. And then we have the pattern of marriage that's stated in each dispensation of time. It's the way God's always wanted marriage to be. In verse 24, "Therefore a man shall leave his father and mother and be joined to his wife, and they two shall become one flesh." And so we have the ingredients. It's a man and a woman. And we have the reordering of their lives. The home she grew up in was the most important home to her. The home he grew up in was the most important home. But when they get married, there's a reordering. You see, now they're to leave. That's a strong word in English, and it's just as strong in Hebrew. It's to break the bond. It's a two-way street. Moms and dads are supposed to let them leave. Sons and daughters are to leave. Why? There is a restructuring. Now the home, their home, is the most important home as far as responsibility and priority that they have themselves on this earth. And they are to be joined. Their lives are to be blended. It's not me and mine, I anymore. Now it's us and we and ours. And we're back to that giant. They're to be one flesh. They're to be faithful to each other. They're to provide for each other, but they are to guard that relationship. Now when we think about the master's people coming into the master's plan, this is how we protect ourselves from that giant of infidelity. Now when we go to Ephesians, the 5th chapter, there's something real interesting when you start really studying this chapter in depth. In Ephesians 5, beginning at verse 22, and I'm not saying that we have to settle this, please don't misunderstand me that. I'm just saying it's just interesting to me that beginning at verse 22, you can study for a little bit and I find myself saying, this is a beautiful passage about husbands and wives, and he uses Christ and the church to illustrate it. Then you read a few more verses, you're like, no. This is a passage about Christ and the church, and he's using marriage to illustrate it. Maybe it's both. Did you notice down toward the end, surely you've noticed before that passage in 32? God says, "This is a great mystery. But I speak concerning Christ and the church." A great mystery. When a 3-year-old comes running up to you and says, grabs you by the hands, come here. I gotta show you something great. And they run you out the front door and they get on the very bottom step before the sidewalk and they jump. And they turn around, "Isn't that great?" And of course, as a mom or dad or grandmother or grandfather, that's great. You know, we have our different levels of what's great. You know, I can tell you some things that I think are great, and you'd probably be like, that's not really so great to me. What about when the God who created the sun and the moon and the stars, all the universe, he created the star Betelgeuse that if it began at the sun, it would pass the earth. That's great. The one who can resurrect individuals from the dead. The one that can make a storm or calm a storm. If he says something's great, it ought to move us to the edge of our seat and say, okay, Lord. He's talked about a mystery several times in the Scriptures, but this one, he says, is a great mystery. He says, I want to talk to you about Christ and the church. Now, if he's linking what he's saying here with the verses right above that, let's drop back and look at those verses right above it, and it's going to sound just like the passage we left, because that's where it comes from. And so, when we drop back in 27, he's saying, or 28, so husbands ought to love their own wives as their own bodies. He who loves his wife loves himself. For no one ever hated his own flesh, but nourishes and cherishes it, just as the Lord does the church. For we are members of His body, of His flesh, and of His bones. We just read about that. And then we read this verse too. For this reason, a man shall leave his father and mother and be joined to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh. And you say, we're talking about marriage here. And he says, no. This is a great mystery, but I speak concerning Christ and the church. What is God showing us here? He's saying, let me show you how you began, wives. You were taken out of the body of your husband, and then you're brought together in marriage to share in a lifetime commitment. But then he says, let me talk to you about the church. Where did the church come from? Christ became flesh and blood, incarnation, and he came and he died. And it's from his body that now we have the church. And the church is to have a union together like a marriage, in that you would devote your life, the rest of your life, to the cause of Christ and His body. And he says, this hasn't always been known. Back in the old covenant, they wouldn't have understood this. But he says, this is a great mystery. That that was unknown is now known. It's how beautiful the church is. And the significance of our commitment to the church, just as you would commit to a marriage. Our source is from the body of Christ. How are we going to slay the giants in our life? We're about to run out of time. Let me give you that third point very quick here. In Psalms 127:1, he talks about, unless the Lord builds the house. We've got to be the Master's people, following the Master's plan. But we also have to realize we have to have the Master's protection. Unless the Lord guards the city, the watchman stays awake in vain. The only way in the Old Testament time period the city could be safe in the evening was for it to be fortified and then watchmen up in the towers watching. And if they were men of courage and strength and dependability, you could go to bed at night and you could rest well knowing that if there was any danger, they would let you know of it. Friends, we can be arrogant and we can think that we can just plow through life and we'll guard ourselves and we'll always love each other and we don't have anything to worry about. We can be humble and recognize that there's not any of us above sin. And recognize that the only way we can ever be protected is to constantly be leaning upon God for His protection. Allow Him to guard the city. In Genesis, the third chapter, we have another introduction. Genesis 1 was an introduction to God. Genesis 2 was an introduction to mankind and marriage. Genesis 3 is an introduction to Satan, our enemy. Tonight I ask you, do you realize that there is an enemy? The day you said, I do, Satan had a goal, a wish, a dream, a desire for your marriage to end in divorce. Or at least, if it stays together, to not glorify God. Be sober. Be vigilant. Because your adversary walks about as a roaring lion, seeking whom he may devour. And if our mindset is, well, I'm just going to make sure that on that grand, horrible giant of infidelity, I'm going to make sure that I don't cross that line right there into that infidelity. We've made a terrible mistake. You see, Proverbs 4 teaches us that it's from the heart that flows the issues of life. What we do, what we say, comes from our heart. Matthew, the 5th chapter, before he taught about marriage and divorce, he taught about lust that was in the heart first. Why? There is a progression. And so he says, we've already sinned when we lust. It's already adultery of the heart. And now he says, if that's not stopped, that's already sin. If that's not stopped, it's going to progress to other things also. So how do you reach the heart? There's only 5 ways to reach the heart. It's the 5 senses that God has created us with. As we close this lesson, I'd invite you to the book of Proverbs. Let's just scan over 5 ways that our heart is touched with infidelity. The first one we see is in Proverbs, the 5th chapter, and in verse 3, and it is taste. And we see the perils of the adulterous woman here in the 5th chapter, in verse 3. It says, for the lips of an immoral woman drip honey, and her mouth is smoother than oil. In the 6th chapter, in verse 24, we see hearing. In the 6th chapter and 24, to keep you from the evil woman, from the flattering tongue of a seductress. And in the verses prior to that, 20 through 22, 23 are strong words of warning. Many of these chapters are here. When we go to Proverbs, the 7th chapter and verse 10, we see the danger of sight. For the woman met him with the attire of a harlot and the crafty heart. How did she look there? And in 13, we see the touch. So she caught him, and we see taste again. She kissed him. And then we go to the 17th verse, and we see smell. I have perfumed my bed with myrrh and aloes and cinnamon. Come, let us take our fill of the love into the morning. Let us delight ourselves with love, for my husband is not at home. And then we come to this conclusion in 24. Now, therefore, listen to me, my children. This is where we began this evening. Pay attention to the words of my mouth. Do not let her heart turn aside to her ways. Do not let your heart turn aside to her ways. Do not stray into her paths, for she has cast down many wounded, and all who are slain by her were strong men. Her house is the way to hell, descending to the chambers of death. Her house or the Lord's house? Notice, it's not your house. We'll all partner with someone, and the wise will allow the Lord to build their house.